There is this thing.
Do you realize
consciousness is affected? There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on.
What
do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's Community News Program, Off the Hour. Today is Friday, August 12th. My name is Alice Wu, and I will be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Ginyangahaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Today, on Friday, Off the Hour, we'll be tuning into an episode of the Indigenous Action Podcast, hosted by Kin Balam. It discusses the nonprofit industrial complex, a web of forces that impair radical organizing efforts and maintain the current capitalist colonial state.
Indigenous Action, where we dig deep into critical issues impacting our communities throughout occupied America.
This is an autonomous anti-colonial broadcast with unapologetic and clause-out analysis towards total liberation.
So take your seat by this fire and may the bridges we burn together light our way.
Yate Tahasin Tlo She'e Kli Dasha Jinne. My name is Kli Benali. I am your host today for the Indigenous Action Podcast. We are excited for today's topic, where we are going to be digging right into addressing the nonprofit industrial complex, which we identify as a system of relationships designed by colonial and capitalist forces to manage and neutralize effective radical organizing and reinforce capitalism and the settler colonial state. Before we get into all that, we're going to listen to a promo from the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network, which we are part of, and you can check them out at channelzeronetwork.com.
Bart, I agree with you in theory. In theory, communism works. In theory. In theory.
So I says to Mabel, I says, "Oh, hello, I'm Tom."
I'm Alicia.
And I'm Nate. And we're the hosts of Works in Theory podcast on the Channel Zero Network. Have you ever been in an argument on Twitter and just wished you could drop a devastating David Graeber quote, but hadn't actually read any of his works? Or are you interested in the foundational works of anarchism and communism, but weren't willing to slog through 300 pages of 19th century text?
Works in Theory podcast has done the hard work for you. We read works like Peter Kropotkin's Mutual Aid or David Graeber's Fragments of an Anarchist Anthropology and make them accessible through casual conversations.
Our whole first season is up now on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and anywhere else you listen to podcasts. Search for Works in Theory Podcast. You can subscribe. You can even go ahead and listen to Works in Theory Podcast because
communism works in theory.
All right, so welcome. This show will address particularly how the indigenous nonprofit industrial complex and capitalists are barriers to building collective power towards liberation. We have some familiar voices that will be joining us today, as well as Morningstar Gali, who is a sister in the movement that I've known for many years, and we've worked together on a range of different actions and struggles, particularly to protect sacred places. We wanted to begin by sharing a bit from Insight, who published the book, The Revolution Will Not Be Funded beyond the nonprofit industrial complex back in 2007. And Insight defines the nonprofit industrial complex, or NPIC, as we'll be referring it to, as a system of relationships between the state or local and federal governments, the owning classes, foundations, and nonprofit slash non-governmental organizations, or NGOs, social service and social justice organizations. They further define the nonprofit industrial complex as a set of symbiotic relationships that link political and financial technologies of state and owning class control with surveillance over public political ideology, including and especially emergent progressive and leftist social movements. And we highly recommend that book because it gives a history of the nonprofit industrial complex and charity work, which obviously when we talk about mutual aid, we talk about solidarity, not charity, and why that has come to be and how in more depth and in anecdotes with a range of different voices and stories, and including Indigenous voices, why the nonprofit industrial complex should be abolished. In their book, Insight provides a sort of outline of some of the concerns that they have. And as a whole, and in the way that which capitalist interests in the state use nonprofits to monitor and control social justice movements, to divert public monies into private hands through foundations, to manage and control dissent in order to make the world safe for capitalism, to redirect activist energies into career-based models of organizing instead of mass-based organizing capable of actually transforming society, to allow corporations to mask their exploitative and colonial work practices through philanthropic work. And the final point that they make is to encourage social movements to model themselves after capitalist structures rather than challenge them. And so with Indigenous Action, we published a piece called Smash the Nonprofit Indigenous Complex, Smash Capitalism. And we outline some other points, which you can check out our piece on our website. We'll have a link in the description for the show as well. But we list out that the NPIC is inherently extractive and colonial. Of course, it upholds capitalism, that nonprofit organizations are more accountable to funders than their communities. They foster abusive power relationships, that their strategies are explicitly reformist, that they can also perpetuate false representation, and that ultimately the overall strategy of the nonprofit industrial complex is colonial, as it upholds unjust power relationships and perpetuates capitalism. And just a note, we recorded this interview in sections due to some scheduling issues with our guests. So with that, yat'e to our guests and welcome. Please introduce yourselves.
Hey, good to see you again. This is Jen Bearcat. I'm Shoshone and Paiute, and I'm calling in today from Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm interested in seeing what we get into today.
This is Kim Balama of the Indigenous Action Podcast.
Chimi Sunwe, thank you so much for having me on. I'm a fan of the podcast, so it's great to be here with all of you. My name is Morningstar Galley. I am Ajumawi Band of Pitt River. And what else can I share? I apologize. It's been a really long day, running on a lack of sleep, kind of as usual here. But I've been organizing here in occupied Ohlone territories throughout Northern California for many years. I could say dating back to just being raised within, a movement of Indigenous justice, and being raised within a movement where we have consistently had to fight for our freedoms, our protections, all of it. And so, just sharing a little bit of that, just coming off of the Apache Stronghold Caravan that has been here over the last few days. So it was an honor to help to host them and help to host a listening session that we held here in Yalamu territory with them.
Yeah, and it's powerful to see. I watched part of the live stream for the after court press conference today, and it reminded me of some of our collaboration, because years ago you helped to coordinate and host us when we were there as far as the Save the Peaks Coalition and bringing that struggle before the Ninth Circuit there. So it was interesting just to reflect on some of the same arguments that were made then, because, you know, we've been in these sacred site battles in the front lines for, it feels like, decades now. And you, of course, doing powerful work to protect Medicine Lake. You know, we really pay attention to these cases, but we also have a lot of negative experiences. So, you know, I think earlier we were talking about a little bit of the optimism and some of the political strategy, legal strategies around that case. And it seemed to be something that reminded me where we were standing there, the, you know, steps of the courthouse or, you know, on occupied Ohlone lands, facing the same battles.
Absolutely. We've had hearings on those same steps and the same Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals on Medicine Lake, on Cave Rock, on the number of times that we've helped to host with Save the Peaks. But yeah, same. It feels kind of exactly what you said, same argument, different day, different decade.
And thank you for sharing that and elaborating a little bit more of your organizing experience. And we're actually going to get into that a little bit more with something that we don't typically do here, was sharing our organizational experience and experience with the nonprofit industrial complex, primarily because in producing the show and thinking about it, some of the pushback that we get in our critiques with the nonprofit industrial complex is that people respond usually with like, well, what have you done? What are you doing? You know, and we don't want to lay out our activist credentials and portfolios and all that, because that's really not what we're interested in. We're not interested in building that kind of world. But I think that with the introductions, we'll be able to provide a sense of the experience and intention and what has really informed our analysis that will help folks who listen to the show and help folks who are building their understandings of why it's important to provide these kinds of critiques in these spaces, especially when so much is at stake. And I'll go first a bit. This is a short, I guess, introduction overview of where I come from, but I was born in the movement, as they say. In 1974, Congress passed PL 93-531, which is a relocation act, which forced the removal of my relatives. More than 20,000 Diné people have been forcibly removed from our ancestral lands up in Black Mesa and Zithagene. And this is also where Remy comes from as well. So we know each other through that and our families. But my family was divided. Part of our lands were, you know, split for the Hopi, part of them split for Diné. And this ultimately was a resource land grab to make way for further resource extraction, because one of the largest strip mine operations for coal was operated by Peabody Coal in this area. And it was an extreme act of conquer and divide for resource extractive industries. So my relatives resisted. I was born in 1975, so it gives you a sense of how old I am, right? And some of my earliest memories were going to the meetings, going to a protests. I had a sign that said BIA, Bureau of Indian Affairs, don't kill me, I'm only three, is one of my earliest memories. Outside a Bureau of Indian Affairs office, relocation office they had here in occupied Kinflena or Flagstaff. And so I really didn't come to my own as far as an organizer until I was 15 years old. But I have a lot of experience, both mainly bad, that has informed what I do, why I do it in terms of the nonprofit industrial complex. In 2007, I helped to start Kalahuan Info Shop. In 2001, I actually helped to start and found Indigenous Action, but it led to Kalahuan Info Shop, which is a radical anti-capitalist resource center in response to a lot of the problems with people exploiting and extracting movements and organizing. I mean, particularly up in Big Mountain, it's important for folks to understand that millions and millions of dollars were made off of that struggle internationally, raised in the name of my relatives, my elders. There was, you know, multiple incidents where my grandmother, Roberta Blackoat's name, was forged on checks and people cashed in and exploited, and just, you know, even our own people exploited, you know, vulnerable elders who were our frontline matriarchs who started that resistance. And this is, you know, what I grew up facing, is just being extraordinarily distrustful and skeptical of why people are there for, you know, these struggles, what that means. and you know, how to challenge that. And so I've grown up with that, exploitation being a reality, very, very detrimental and dangerous in our communities. So, and I also have experiences I'll talk later on about the struggle to protect the San Francisco Peaks, where that struggle was, we had people coming in to try to undermine and exploit that as well. But we ultimately drew the line saying that this is a spiritual struggle for the protection of this land, this mountain that is holy to 13 indigenous nations, and nobody should be here because they have a paycheck. And this is a spiritual struggle, so it demands that. So that's a lot of what and why I do what I do. But yeah, that's a bit of my short introduction.
I took a little bit of a different route. I feel like compared to some of the rest of the speakers here today, I wasn't raised within like a strong like resistance family or anything, or as far as I knew when I was younger. I actually began my work when I was at a tribal college. I had gone to the college actually just to get off the streets, and it was more out of necessity. And then I found out I was actually still pretty good at school, so it became my hustle. We just started out as like a group of friends that got bored, and so we started organizing little events and stuff. And then unfortunately, we at our school experienced a very horrific incident where a young woman was raped on campus. And we kind of we felt that we had to turn our attention to that, and it got into more of I guess alcohol awareness and just personal safety, I guess, as coming from indigenous communities or as indigenous people coming to a larger urban area where there is a high crime rate and there things like this happen there. And so we had to conduct ourselves differently, and we wanted to, I guess, alert the other students of this when they were coming in. And when we just started out as a group of friends doing this, and then the next semester, I was surprised when I found out that the college had actually commissioned a grant writer, and she had a secretary, and there was a bunch of, and you know, so they had like, I guess, three grants or something that they scored from like the Office of Women's Health and SAMHSA and these bigger, I mean, these large government corporations or entities. And so I started getting paid to do it, and I was like, oh, yeah, that's cool. And it was kind of like a work study thing. And by the time, you know, my time there was up, you know, I was running a program. I had basically written a program, and I had, you know, anywhere between 17 and 35 students under me that were working also. And so we would do trainings and things like this, and they actually wrote a curriculum for the college. And I didn't even, at that time, I didn't even know that this was like a field. I didn't know it was a job until I got ready to transfer. And then I was like, because I was done with all my credits at the college. And so I was going to transfer to a four-year school. And I was like, man, I remember thinking, man, wouldn't it be cool if I got to do this as like a job? That would be the coolest. I didn't even know that it existed as, I didn't know organizing was like a paid thing. Then I was told. And so I went into sociology when I transferred, and I got a four-year degree, and I went in directly into what I thought was my dream job right out of college. I was working with the social services program for a local pueblo, and it was a really good job. I enjoyed it. I was successful at it. And but then I started seeing like the edges started to come up, and I started seeing the faults. And when I started calling them on their ethical issues, they didn't like that. And that became kind of like a resounding thing that happened with me. I felt like I couldn't find an org that actually was ethical, or, you know, and it wasn't small ethical shit. It was like big shit. Like, why are you even doing that? It was just astounding to me when I started seeing the bigger picture of it. And I came to the point where, you know, I was eventually blackballed from my industry, and I couldn't really get a job in it anymore, and I didn't want a job in it anymore. And I realized at that point that this is a whole big industry. This is an industry. and it makes a lot of money, and it provides a lot of passes for the entire country, the entire government. And I figured out that at the end of the day, it is a threat. And I really started focusing, especially after Standing Rock, after what we experienced up there. That was the first time that, like, I'd ever personally experienced a lot of the governmental efforts towards silencing the resistance. A lot of the things that we saw out there was really eye-opening.
Instead of giving, like, a biographical background, I'll just... My background will come out in how I talk about the nonprofit. The main argument at a fundamental level that everyone makes is that it's a necessary evil, the nonprofit and working with them. My question has always been, why is it necessary and is it necessary? And I would argue it's coercive. You know, the majority of my interaction with nonprofit organizations were namely nonprofit legal aid in one way, shape, or form. And that's because that allowed and provided for coverage for anything I did. Then within that was also seeing systematically the work that myself or grassroots organizations that I was part of would be co-opted by a nonprofit as it swoops in to take it over. And more often than not, they were inexperienced. And the only thing that really prevented them from being able to co-opt stuff was having an experienced, cohesive nonprofit, not nonprofit, sorry, experienced, cohesive and militant group that was already in place, so that it was not easily persuaded or waylaid or redirected away from stuff. And then inevitably what you would see is the same nonprofit organizations, and particularly the people involved in it, that, and I would argue that in reality what nonprofits do is they create neocolonialism, because that's what they want to reproduce. They want to reproduce a capitalist agent and a settler agent that wants to create complicity and kind of a cooperative relationship with the state, and which is to say the settler institutions as they are. And what they'll inevitably do is place themselves as gatekeepers and intermediaries. And if they can't do that, then they start systematically attacking you. And you can actually see the insidious and insincere side of these supposed people. Everyone says, oh, but they're good people. You may have a good person in an organization. That does not mean that the organization doesn't have its own mind structurally and institutionally that makes it do certain things just to serve its own interests, or that a leader is somehow of that organization not going to be aligned with the organization's self-interest. They're a leader of that organization because they are aligned with the organizational self-interest, not the communities, not whatever the issue is, not the notion of justice, not the notion of land back or whatever it may be. And then in the modern sense, what we're seeing has been, like, and I described this in a previous podcast, is the industrialization, not just of industrial complex, but the industrial production of professional activists that inevitably cut their militant teeth or wave their militant flag, if you will, by virtue of their work in a nonprofit. That's one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is also seeing how the necessities of capitalism continually undermine, and the colonial state, because they're intertwined, continually undermine grassroots organizing by taking some of the best and most capable people and making them dependent and exclusively employable within the nonprofit space. And what that does is it removes
the element of actually struggling to kind of undermine something. Because in essentially, when it comes to Indigenous organizing, fundamentally, we're all insurgents. You know, if we're not insurgents, we're collaborators, right? And if that is not in your head, you haven't asked that question, then you should easily recognize what side of the line you're on. And we're not on the same side of the line, you know? And so the nonprofit then sits in there as an arbiter for the state or an apologist for the state. And it fundamentally is like, it's a form of like soft power, if we want to use that like generic term. And they become more and more and more important. What we're actually seeing domestically within the US and I'd say Canada is we're seeing the NGOization of movements that were being contended with during the anti-globalization movement primarily. You'd see in spaces like Chiapas or in Peru or Bolivia, wherever, you would see NGOs move into that space with nonprofit money and doing anything from developing projects to water projects to schools or what have you, the carrot, if you will, in order to undermine what was going to be autonomous organizing in that space and the power that was being developed and that the way that they were doing it independent of the reliance on their own state. So instead, they become an outside agent. An outside agent comes in and becomes dependent on an outside agent to enable what they're doing and derail the actual progress that they're actually achieving. And we're just seeing the same thing happen domestically. It had already, we'd already been seeing that for years and years and years, but now it's just more pronounced. And it's become kind of the, it is the culture today.
Morningstar, you have a lot of experience in and outside of the nonprofit industrial complex. So curious if you could share some of your experiences and concerns and maybe some pointers beyond, you know, organizing outside or beyond the nonprofit industrial complex.
Sure. I think just as was mentioned a little bit earlier, some of the organizing, you know, I can remember with the San Francisco Peaks caravan when there were caravans traveling out here. And so we were, you know, scrambling to just figure out, you know, what the media support was going to look like, what it was very grassroots. I remember that we were organizing essentially out of my home, out of my auntie's home, you know, had media support out of the vehicles. And there were a number of local organizations that basically showed up to the events, showed up to the welcoming events and, you know, handed us their card and was like, hey, if we would have known about this, we could have helped here. You know, here's our card. And afterwards, I just kind of saw what unfolded was, you know, them taking credit for a lot of this work that we were doing, you know, pulling. I was a student at the time, so I just remember using, you know, what little like student like FAFSA funds that I had and, you know, really just trying to pull things together. And I think the same thing happened, you know, with the Longest Walk 2 back in 2008. There were a number of organizations and especially Native-led organizations that really kind of clenched on and took credit for some of that work. And so I think that was very eye-opening for me. I just coming from a place of where there wasn't any really funding resources available. I think there's kind of the go-tos that I've, you know, seen you mention, but there's also, you know, these white-led organizations that have created these, you know, indigeneity programs. I won't mention any names, but I'll say Bioneers, for example. Even this past Sunrise Gathering that we held on Alcatraz Island, I was really going back and forth with them because they put this big event page up on the main Bioneers social media and said that they were hosting a live stream of our Sunrise Gathering. And so I contacted them and said, no, you're not. you're not going to do that. You've continued to co-opt Indigenous peoples. You've continued to really profit off of us and off of our struggles. And so you're not going to show up and you're not going to think that you can just, you know, show up. And I think I made a post or something that said, you know, that, you know, the same, it's the same kind of ongoing exploitation that they've continued to participate in. So, you know, it's a lot of the same issues over many decades, where it doesn't seem to change very much.
It's interesting that you bring up the Save the Peaks court case, particularly because when we organized that, and that was back in 2006, in the midst of this massive sacred sites battle that was really definitive in terms of the legal issues, because it was one of the first cases to test the, or it was the first case to test the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in relation to sacred lands. And we had spent months building up to mobilize for that. And at that time, I was working with, you know, people in the Ruckus Society. For those of you all who don't know who they are, they're a direct action group that was formed after the 1999 WTO, IMF, World Bank resistance uprising in Seattle. And they were a direct action group that did trainings and also sort of parachuted in different activists as, you know, quote unquote, allies to support environmental and social justice frontline organizing. And they are, that organization is what, you know, ultimately led to the formation of the Indigenous People's Power Project, or IP3. And so I was working with all of these people, and we had done a lot of outreach building up to our case going to San Francisco, so-called San Francisco Ohlone lands. And I remember we had all these events planned. We had, you know, sunrise ceremonies. We had a caravan of over 100 people from our lands, you know, elders, and we were at the time working with, you know, tribal leadership and spiritual leaders, because we had a very broad-based coalition in environmental groups. And one of the things that you said to me, because we were frustrated that we didn't get the kind of support, we were challenging a lot of these nonprofit, like big NGO or non-governmental organization groups, environmental groups particularly, to step up and support anti-colonial struggle to defend sacred lands. Because at the time, it was just an emergent like issue, but it was becoming a trend. And so I was remarking of the challenges, and you, I remember this very clearly, you stated to me that you were shocked and amazed how much support we had gotten. But our group was sort of frustrated because we didn't get what we felt like it should have been, because one of the things that, from what I remember you said, and you probably remember this more, was that Indigenous people were completely invisibilized there, and the issues weren't like quote unquote sexy, you know, or trendy on that level. And so, you know, the important part to me of these lessons, and this is what made me as well very concerned with the nonprofit industry and what deepened my sort of antagonism towards them, was is that the way they used our organizing, like, because we were staunchly grassroots, we refused foundation funding, we refused to write grants because we saw exploitation, and we made that commitment saying that if we're here to protect our sacred lands, then we shouldn't be getting paid for it. This is a spiritual struggle, so it demands some kind of sacrifice and discipline. And we're not here for reward. We don't want people to come for the wrong reasons, just for a paycheck or with their hands out. We want to make sure people know that we're here because it's a principled matter that we're addressing on a spiritual level. And we were instructed, you know, we were counseled by our own spiritual practitioners to approach that issue in this way. And so that was a huge lesson that I learned of how these nonprofit groups will co-opt issues if they're trendy. How then afterwards, after that court battle, we saw groups that had offered almost no support, who had actually shut the door on us pretty much, or shut people out while we were planning events, turn around and say that they had supported our effort in their newsletters and asked for people to donate to their organizations. And it was just so disingenuous and disrespectful that was part of, you know, this whole abuse that we've seen. So I don't know. I mean, I don't want to get too much into the details of those experiences, but you just brought that up, and it just reminded me, looking at the Apache, you know, strongholds efforts with Oak Flat, of what we went through back then.
Absolutely, and it still continues to today. And so not only are Indigenous peoples invisibilized on our own lands, especially here in California, especially with the uniqueness of tribes here within California, that we there are 109 federally recognized tribes, but we have over 55 tribes that are considered NFR. They're non-federally recognized. We have disenfranchised tribal communities. We have disenrolled tribal families and peoples. We have state-recognized tribes. We have terminated tribes. And so it's really interesting that, you know, the response, when I talk about every day as a California Indigenous woman, every day is a fight for visibility. Every day is a fight against the erasure of us through, you know, what happened with gold, greed, and genocide efforts in the extermination of us as a peoples. And so, so those organizations not only shut their doors on us, they told us, I remember they said, oh, well, we're in our strategic planning. We are having a retreat. We can't help you. We can't even offer our office space so that we could, you know, get any printing done. And so, it was just really interesting to me that they had, you know, all of these resources available, that they had office space, that they, you know, it was within their reach, but they, you know, said, you know, it wasn't, you know, it just didn't fit at that time. And I was just like, well, if you're in your strategic planning phase, like, what does that mean for us? Like, this is the time. This is when we need this help. This is when we need the support. And I think it was definitely at that time. And so to, you know, just to reflect on that and to just see, like, here we are now in, you know, in a time where Indigenous people struggles are sexy to an extent, that they are visible. Everyone's a water protector now, right? Like, all of these organizations are claiming that they're doing frontline work with Indigenous peoples and communities. They're all claiming that they're grassroots when they have these multi-million-dollar budgets. And so it's really just interesting to see how all of that is being navigated. And so I'm using California as an example because that parachuting is still taking place. Ruckus is still very much in existence, from what I understand, on occupied Ohlone lands. I'm not sure exactly what they do. I know they had one of the largest camps at Standing Rock with just an outrageous amount of tech. Like, they had their own office in the middle of, you know, this ongoing battle that was being waged. They were telling folks that they couldn't camp within their area because that was their training grounds. They had yurts set up. I mean, it was pretty obscene in terms of, you know, the camp and the setup that they had. And so, yeah, just kind of watching from the outside of that and just watching how all of this has been navigated through the years. It really shows the exploitation, that it's not only the resource extraction that we have to worry about with non-Native peoples, but that it is through our own peoples and our own communities that, you know, will take advantage of that and will make that effort as well.
It's funny that you bring up Ruckus because everything that you said about Standing Rock is absolutely true. And then some. We're seeing it today repeated by Indian Collective. But also, in addition to that, people, I don't know if people know this, but Ruckus is actually currently, they're helicoptering in and, parachuting in? I don't know what they call it, but to the Thacker Pass issue right now, they're actually the ones that have been offering the quote-unquote direct action training for a lot of the people on the ground there. And being that our, due to our history, our people don't have a very strong presence as far as political education and as far as frontline experience. And so they and it's being largely ran by a lot of the orgs. And so they brought them in with no problem. And I was like, wait a minute. I thought these guys were shut down. But yeah, that was problematic when I saw them there, but I guess nobody else saw the problem.
And this is the thing that I think a lot of people don't understand is the Indigenous organizing circles are pretty small. We all know each other. We are related to each other. We've worked with each other throughout our histories. And part of that's because we come from movement families, or, you know, we cross paths a lot with the work that we do. And there are deep histories with a lot of the folks behind these entities that we know or we worked with in the past.
A lot of times when we have these conversations, we individualize it. And this is where a lot of our problems come in, is because we attach it to certain orgs or certain people or certain things. That's a problem, and that distracts away from, that allows people to get defensive about, oh, well, that's my friend, or, oh, that org helped this thing, or that org isn't that bad, or, you know, when it distracts away from the entire problem of it, which is the complex, and it's not the org, each org, it's not each person. I mean, yeah, it is, but at the same time, that's not what we're addressing here. And the fact is that people don't understand that. Like, you brought up the military industrial complex, and it plays right into this and exactly into this, because I have some family members that are actually active military, and they're pretty high ranking. And one of the things that they're trying to do is to learn the language of the places that they're going into. And let's not get it twisted. What they're going to do is colonize. They're going into these spaces to colonize it. And one of the things, when you look back, when you read back on the reports from Tiger Swan about their reports back of their intel, they said that they could observe and they can survey a lot of the planes were constantly flying overhead 24 hours a day, helicopters, planes, everything. They were taking pictures all the time. And but one of the things that they noted in their report back was that they could not infiltrate what they quote unquote called leadership meetings, or meetings where, you know, the plays were getting called, because that's what they were looking for. That's a structure they know. They don't know indigenous structures, and so they can't find what they don't know how to look for, right? Well, that's why they depend on infiltrators. They depend on infiltrators to go in to target these certain things. But if we don't have those certain things, they can't really target it, right? That is exactly what scouts were used for back in the day, because when you go into all these new places, you don't have time to train people to learn the language, learn the customs, learn everything of that. That's why they adopt, what are they, scouts? Or like when they go into Iraq, they get somebody from Iraq to come on their little team, and they, not supervise, but they like go and they tell them all the local customs and stuff if they're messing up or whatever, the troops. They depend on that, right? But they downplay it. And so when they come into movement spaces, especially indigenous movement spaces, I mean, it was no mistake that they in their internal documents addressed us like we're the jihad. They called us jihadists, because that's how they know how to deal with us, because they know that they're coming into a culture that they don't understand. And so that's why they depend on scouts still to do that work for them, except for when they can't recruit scouts, when there isn't enough Heath Harmons, or, you know, the guy that set up Red Fawn, when there isn't enough of those that can get into the sensitive places, how else are they going to get that information? Nonprofits. Because when you have, if you've ever written a grant, you will understand that you have to, you know, all the paperwork and stuff and all the details that you have to provide in providing that, in applying for that grant. Even if you don't, if your grant does not get chosen, if you don't get awarded, you're still giving them that information. So now they have all this information coming in to them from all these different spaces and all these different movements, and boom, now they don't really, you know, it's a substitute for the scouts. I mean, we're doing a good job as far as our security goes, but these nonprofits are our weak space right now. And I just really wanted to call that to attention. Like, when we talk about nonprofits or scouts, it's not that it's name calling, and we're describing the job that they're doing. And it's not, maybe it isn't intentionally done on their part. I mean, I was in the nonprofits for a long time, and I didn't understand what I was doing. I didn't realize that they were milking me for this or that. I didn't understand what being tokenized was when I was in it. And when I got out of it, I was like, damn, I got played. And I felt bad. I felt bad for a long time. I still feel bad about it. But at the same time, like, I didn't know. And so I go into, when we go into criticizing these nonprofits and stuff, it's like, I go into it with that, because I know that they probably don't know, but I need them to know. We need them to know. And that's why we speak on this.
And there's context for this. The Revolution Will Not Be Funded has an essay by Madonna Thunderhawk, who was part of the Women's Ballred Nation, which has formed a connection with the American Indian Movement. and they did incredible work without a single foundation grant. But her essay reminds us that their organizing was able to accomplish much, if not more, outside of the nonprofit system. And this is something key when we look at globally indigenous struggles, who fight, who struggle, who have amazing resistance and liberatory struggles that are ongoing without nonprofit support. This seems to be something very much, quote unquote, American. And I think the capitalist context is key. But Morningstar, you want to talk about how AIM now in Southern, in California is becoming a nonprofit?
All I can honestly do is laugh about it. And so here within California, in Northern California, there is an AIM chapter that was sanctioned by the Grand Governing Council, by the national AIM leadership. And this AIM group has formed a 501c3. They are a nonprofit. They are an official nonprofit within California, where they are claiming that they're doing work on behalf of missing and murdered Indigenous peoples and the American Indian movement. And so just in terms of the background, I definitely personally took issue with it, felt like there were a number of, you know, I don't know what else to call them other than these newbie AIM activists that really feel like they have something to prove. And so, you know, for those of us that were raised in the movement, we understand that, you know, we understand the threats, we understand the surveillance, we understand, I mean, even current day, the organizing that I do with the Anti-Police Terror Project, I co-lead the Healing Justice Committee. It's all volunteer led and run, and, you know, constantly tending to the needs of families that have been impacted by state violence. And so, and even that, we've witnessed the co-optation of that, right? Like, APTP are the folks that came up with defunding the police messaging and language. And we've seen how nonprofits now are using that in their LOIs and, you know, asking how we can have this, you know, safer world away from policing when they are very much a part of the problem and the violence that's being committed against communities of color. And so, yeah, to have this nonprofit, you know, formed and to have this leadership that absolutely no one that's actually been a part of AIM, none of them recognize, we don't recognize it in any form or fashion, but just to, you know, see this call for donations, this call for support, that they are this entity, it's absolutely disgusting.
With my efforts within nonprofits and social services departments, I felt like I was doing work that was necessary, which it was, but also I was being derailed from, I was being sucked in basically, and I totally lost my path. People don't understand a lot of times that a lot of Natives actually don't understand. This is where the issue lies, is that a lot of Natives don't understand that our existence is anti-colonial, period. And it doesn't matter what we do, as long as we are working in our best interests, we are anti-colonial. So, and there are consequences for that. There's consequences for not being fully American and fully Americanized, for not making concessions. There are consequences for that, and on the contrary, there are rewards for being colonial, for being in line with the system. And that's what we're seeing now with these nonprofits and stuff. Like, they're the ones that get funding. They're the ones that can come in and like IP3 and say they were at Standing Rock and stuff, but then none of them got arrested. You didn't see any of them during time, right? We're not writing to any of them in the fucking prisons, right? We need to understand that our existence has been criminalized, because that is the basis of America. We can't help that, and we don't want to help that. That's just our being. And that's not to say that there aren't good people among us. I mean, I feel like we're the best people. I'm biased, though, but hey, what are you going to do? but at the same time, we need to understand that this is a real thing. It's a real it has real consequences in life, in our lives. When we go to, there needs to be a distinction, and I see this getting played out a lot. A lot of people that are working, and they don't understand that there's a difference between community organizing and frontline. When we say frontline, it doesn't mean that you are a community organizer that organized an action. It means that you are resisting all colonial input. It means that you are sticking to the goal 100%. As far as my personal life, the reason why I feel that this needs to be called out now, and it should have been called out a long time ago, but this, just like we talk about intergenerational trauma that has influenced us in our current day, like, for instance, I come from the Duck Valley Shoshone Paiute Reservation, and back in the 70s, John Trudell came out there because he married one of our relatives, and she was doing really good work in the community, and her dad actually happened to be the tribal, our leader. And I've looked into the dossiers, and they were actually being targeted, and John Trudell was linked in through AIM, and so it was a major threat because the fact that our tribe actually started going more autonomous. Our tribe was moving away from the BIA. We were thinking about kicking the BIA out and going back to our traditional structures. And it was in really real motion, and that was a huge threat to the government. And so when we talk about Tina Manning and the fire that happened, it was a very real thing, and it influenced a whole generation after that. Like, when I came around, it was a couple years later after the fire. But since then, there hasn't been any real, like, organizing there because our community was so impacted by that. We have a small community. And, we lay dormant for a little while just because we're recovering. But now we see with Thacker Pass coming in, and now we have no organizers. We have nobody on the ground there that are frontliners. Because we spent a whole, we took the time that we needed to heal. But now it's left us unprepared for this current battle. And this is why it's important to recognize all these impacts on our generational timelines. So when IP3 is coming in and exerting themselves, it's like they're exerting themselves on nations they know there's a space there for them. They know that we don't have any frontliners because our families were busy dealing with our traumas from the government. And we were raised, I remember when I first started going into community organizing, and I remember my mom telling me about the fire and my grandma telling me about the fire and how she used to babysit those kids. And just watching her cry, and it was really impactful. So when we talk about frontlining, and when we talk about what it means and the power that it has, there's weight behind it. It's a real thing. It's a powerful thing. And when we're frontlining, there's real risk to it. And this is what these nonprofits and these academics don't understand, because they don't face it. They're bought into the system already, so they don't face the same consequences that we do, because they don't carry the same power that we do. So understand that there's a difference between community organizing and frontlining, and we need to go back to frontlining. That's where we make the difference. Otherwise, we're just buying into that.
I think you bring up a very provocative point regarding nonprofits and frontlines, and if a nonprofit can be a frontliner. I think part of the challenging dynamic is that they can buy their way onto the front liner. So it's fronting, not frontlining, and artificially create, these sort of theatrical protests that appear radical or challenging, the root causes on a deeper level rather than just reforms and replicating the systems that we're fighting in, which they're benefiting from. And this is a challenge because there are certain dynamics that are very misleading, like just the language that's used. Something as simple as a collective, like Indian collective, for example, because you can't be a collective if you have a hierarchical organization with a president, CEO that are paying themselves hundreds of thousands of dollars for their staff every year. There's something extraordinarily misleading about that. And this is the big challenge about how misleading these groups can be, how artificial their postures can be, because at the end of the day, they're cashing in. And as Remy has said in the past, is it cash back or is it land back? Because in these terms, there doesn't seem to be much difference. And this is, to me, something we've talked about in other terms, and I think in another show we'll bring up about the pacification and this sort of like, not a little bit more about nonviolent direct action and so forth, as far as the constraints of these strategies from nonprofits and what they project and what they then create the infrastructure that becomes replicated down the line for what is viable resistance and struggle. But the issue is that this is really missionizing. I mean, we take a step back and look at, a global context. I don't think there's anywhere else in the world that operates the same way that nonprofits do within the U.S. context. But when you look at the way nonprofits are exported, they're missionizing projects throughout the world, I think we can see a dynamic that is really dangerous. And take that perspective and look back at what's happening as an exceptional model of this gross expression of capitalism that is manipulating social and ecological movements for justice. And to me, this is really a big key part of what really has to be addressed when we're talking about these nonprofits, this operating environment, the context of these systems of oppression, because this is a facade. This is really a gross way of maintaining capitalism. I mean, look at Indian collectives, their primary board member and milkman for the philanthropic world, who wrote this book, Decolonizing Wealth, which Indian Collective uses as a structure for their whole strategy. They use the term anti-capitalism, yet at the end of the day, they're more interested and invested in maintaining.
Welcome back to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. You were just listening to the Indigenous Action Podcast, based on occupied lands in Flagstaff, Arizona. To hear the rest of the episode, head to the website indigenousaction.org, click on Podcasts, and then look for Episode 12, which is titled Abolishing the Nonprofit Industrial Complex. And that concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The collective includes Brian Jefferson, Alice Wu, Joel Salmadal, Killian Davenport-Brown, Tess Pilkington, Pranjal Malik, Moisha Mori, Rima Raji, Michael Edelson, and Sarah Jesmer. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 2593. Or you can email newsintern@ckut.ca. Also, you can follow us on Instagram at CKUTMTL. Or connect with us on Facebook. Search for CKUT. Stay tuned for Cafe, coming up next.
This is the Amanda Galas. You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Anthony à l'appareil, je suis très heureux d'être des vôtres. C'est ma première fois avec les vrais boutons, avec les vrais pinouches dans le studio avec vous. Ce soir, je suis accompagné d'Esther. On fait un petit spécial Festival de jazz de Montréal. Tout le long de l'émission, on va vous présenter nos coups de cœur.